Good evening, Alpharetta.
Good evening.
Yeah. My name is Damon, and I am an alcoholic.
Amen.
And I have to remember that what that means is alcohol is not my problem. You know, how many times did you quit on your own? If I remove the alcohol, if alcohol is my problem, I remove the alcohol, my problems go away, right? Well, that wasn't the case for me. What I did is I get a little restless. I get a little irritable. I get a little bit discontent. And it kind of builds up like a pressure cooker, you know. And then I finally change my mind about not drinking. Anybody ever change your mind about not drinking? It didn't, you know, maybe I was a little premature, you know. And besides, you know, one just tonight, you know, tomorrow is another day. And then I'd kick it off and have that drink and it'd be 2, 3 weeks, 4 months, whatever it was. Finally, I'd reach this terrible point again, and I quit again. You know? I do want to thank Michael for recommending me, you know, in the original form of the, is it the ninth tradition? He said, we prefer to have our friends recommend us. And I really appreciate that, and thank you, Troy. This guy, he really follows up. I mean, I've been getting texts and emails. You got to keep him around at least another week, okay? You got my vote on that. Troy, great job. Thank you for the invitation. I just came back from being at the Rock, and it was the first time that I went to Rock Eagle. It's a men's retreat. This was the 69th one they've had. They have, it's twice a year. And for some reason, each time I wanted to go, there was some event that was happening, either in March or in October, in March and October. Finally, last October, I said, I'm just going to go. And by the way, Owen, our close friend, wanted to be down there too. So, and I heard a lot of things. I'll tell you what I saw. There's 400 men there in sobriety. And I think there's one thing that distinguishes the alcoholics who come in here and stay and wind up getting sober. And I think that's that we're seekers. You know, it's not just that we have a problem. There's a lot of people have a problem with alcohol. But this is, to me, so much of this whole thing has to do with quality. You know, finding a quality of life. Today I know that I don't spend any time not drinking. I really don't. And there's a great story I heard and I read about, and it's the hunters, the bushmen of the Kalahari, and it's how they hunt the gazelle. And the gazelle has body hair, has no sweat glands, so all the heat has to come out of its mouth. Okay, it's very fast, okay? But as humans, we have no body hair, and we have sweat glands, and we're upright, and we communicate. And so they get out there, and the way they hunt the gazelle is they get the gazelle running to here and running to there and running to there until eventually the gazelle passes out standing up from heat exhaustion. And they walk up with a pointed stick and they stab it right in the heart. You see the analogy? I'm not geared up to run from the drink. You know, it tells us in how it works. God could and would if he were sought. So what I find out is when I was stopping drinking, it didn't work. When I sought a quality life, when I sought how to be a good father, how to be a good husband, how to be a good citizen of the world, when I wanted that more than I wanted to change the way I felt, all of a sudden my life changed and I began, something happened. I am a native of Atlanta. I was born in Georgia Baptist Hospital. It's not even around anymore. It's Atlanta Regional, I think. And 1955, I'm 60 years old. And grew up in East Point. I've got two older sisters. My parents, very loving situation. You know, when it really comes down to it, there's an inappropriate question that I read about. And there's a couple of inappropriate questions. But this inappropriate question starts with the word why. Turns out there's never been an answer to a question why in the history of mankind, in my mind. Done a lot of reading on it. I've done a lot of meetings for 10 years. I was doing the meetings down at the Cobb County Jail, and these guys are down there, and they have a lot of time to figure out why they're there. You know, why me? Why me? Why me? Turns out that Everything has a cause. And for that cause, there's another cause. And for that cause, there's another cause. It's like coming to a brick wall in space. I'll tell you what, I'll give an example of my kids. My kids would say, why do I have to go to school? So you get an education. Why do I have to get an education? So you can get a job. Why do I have to have a job? Oh, so you can make money. Why do we have to have money? Well, I think it's because of the failure of the barter economies in the history of mankind. Well, why did they fail? I don't know. I wasn't there. And we don't have a chapter in the big book called Why It Works. We have a chapter called How It Works. And the how it works is each and every one of you in this room drank and did whatever you did to change the way you felt for a different reason. Right? None of us did it for the same reason. And then we have another chapter called There Is a Solution. So here's the neat deal. If I'm knee-deep in mud, what good is the answer to the question, why am I knee-deep in mud, going to do me? Does it do any good? I like this guy. I said, okay, then let's just assume then that you drank the way you drank because your mama had a square nipple and she potty trained you sideways. Now, what are you going to do with that information? Well, you're going to practice these principles in all your affairs, carry this message to the alcoholic who still suffers, and seek a conscious contact with a God we just can't possibly understand. But, and for me, it is the answer to the question. Every time I sit there and try and figure out an answer to a question, why, it's like musical chairs. You know, I ask a question why, and I get a certain answer, then the phone rings. And that's my answer to my question why sits down. And then later on, I'll pick it back up again, and I'll mull it around, and I got a little bit better angle, and then got to go to work or something. You know. So it just constantly changes, and there's no sad. Have you ever had a satisfactory answer to a question why? It just always becomes how. And I do this. I'm a business consultant, and I don't think businesses need to wonder about why about any of that stuff. What we need to do is it's a set of processes. A business is a set of processes. If you get the process right, the outcomes are going to take care of themselves. So this program is a set of processes. So I've got this family that I don't got any excuses. I don't have a big why out there. It says I was, you know, abused. I'm not saying anything about anybody that has. I'm just saying I don't have that. And my dad, when I was 6 years old, took a traveling job. But before he took that job, he sat me down and asked if it was okay that he travel. And that's the role model that I got. And I still did the things I did. No excuse. Well, at 6 years old, I had a pull your pants down club with a girl down the street. We were the only two members. Did anybody else get pleasure by sneaking around? Anybody else? You know? And if you can get away with it, hey, that's even better, you know? And I remember all kinds of, that was like my whole history, pleasure by sneaking around. And we moved up to, when my dad got the job, we moved up to Marietta in 1964 and grew up around that area. And I had trouble at this little elementary school. I kept getting paddled there. By the way, they give some of the kids now Ritalin. Back then, they gave us paddling. And I heard that from a speaker the other day. I liked it, you know, because these guys decorated the paddle. Oh, I had a sick mind. You're going to hit this little kid with it, and they decorated it, you know. But anyway, they took me to a child psychologist. My parents really couldn't afford that. You know, just a traveling salesman, nothing. But that's kind of how they were. And they said, well, he's bored, you know. Today I asked the question, what's the difference between boredom and serenity? Happens in the same framework, doesn't it? You know, what is the difference between boredom and serenity? Can't be the outside stuff. Right? So anyway, I go to this private school and I'm kind of the bottom of the run. I mean, I'm really bullied by a couple of guys. I see them in now reunions and they're like, oh boy, we really treated you better. But what's crazy about it is in the neighborhood I was at, I was in one of the first houses up there, and I was the ringleader up there, and we had a three-story tree hub with three sections. They had a bike parking deck there. In fact, I remember the guy Russell, we had him try out the bike parking deck, and he rode up the ramp and right off the back, into the floor of the woods. And we go up and we look over, say, Russell, you okay? And he goes, I think we need a rail. I said, good idea. Good, Russell. We had him test out everything, you know. But I'm kind of the ringleader there. You know, we had a built-in spinner for spin the bottle in the third level. I don't think we ever used it for spin the bottle, but we were hopeful, you know. And so I'm going to this private school and living up in Marietta, and I'm a child of the 60s. Any other child of the 60s around here? You know, they say if you remember it, you weren't there. But I used to hitchhike down to downtown Atlanta and around the strip. I'd sit around and sell joints, single rolled up joints in the park down there. A buck a piece, actually. Made money off of that, too, selling a buck a piece. But it was a time, and there was drinking and all that going on. But one thing had happened at that time, and one of those hippies that I met, a guy named David Perkins, and he asked me a question. He said, is it a coincidence you're a Christian in a Christian country? If it's the truth of the universe, why does it matter where you're born? I thought, that's a very interesting question for a 15-year-old. And I was sitting up on top of Kennesaw Mountain one time, and I was trying to imagine the curve of the earth, you know. And I got this, that's a, you know, this is a really big thing we're sitting on. You know, it really is amazing. And I started wondering what's on the other side. Well, my parents ran away from home when I was 17 and moved to Alabama. You know, they wanted me to come down to live on the lake there with them. And I said, this is a town of 2,000. I've been in the big city, you know. So I moved down to 12th Street between Peachtree and West Peachtree and worked at Blue Cross Blue Shield. Had the greatest title I ever remember having. I was chief inserter, which that was a great title. But I was running a Phillipsburg six-station inserting machine in the mailroom. And I was a hard worker, you know. I was given good ethics. I was, you know, and around that time I quit smoking weed, and the people who were around the circle just disappeared, except a couple, you know, and I found out who the real friends were, you know, not the ones who were just there. And I decided, though, that I saw these guys working there and that had college educations, and I thought, you know, it might not be so bad to actually get a college education. Has anybody ever been told that you have great potential if you only applied yourself? Anybody? I see a lot of nods out there, you know. Well, I actually applied myself. I went down. It was a little junior college down in Alabama, so it was kind of like continuation of high school in Alabama. And I mean, I did 4.0s and all. But I applied myself. I actually did the work, and then my parents were real happy. And so they said, well, I said, where could I go to school? He said, with your grades, just about anywhere. And I said, so I wanted to go for higher education, so I went to Colorado. And I called up the long-distance information. You could do it back then. There was no internet or anything. And I just called them up and asked them, what colleges do you have in Colorado? Oh, Colorado and Colorado State. And I went, nope, hold on. And I pulled a penny out of my pocket, and I flipped it, and it was tails. And I chose Colorado State. Now, that was my planning for higher education. Turns out I have a lot of well, one girl called Coinky Dinky in my life, and I now know that there's something else going on. I don't understand it, but there's something else. But it turns out that college actually had a good program in Eastern history, and they actually taught Chinese language, and I was very interested in that, so that's what I majored in. When I met my wife in that first week, and we're now married for 36 years now, so. But I like the guy I said, we never decided to divorce each other at the same time. And also, one of the other things we did before getting married is we said divorce is no option. There's no reason to get married if divorce is going to be an option. You know, you might as well just live together. And my wife is, when I met her, she was taking woodworking, welding, and anatomy. She's an occupational therapist. She had burn holes in her jeans from the welding. She had stains on her finger from the woodworking. And she smelled of formaldehyde because they were dissecting a corpse. And I thought, this is an interesting lady, you know. This I could live at a lady like that, you know. So, in fact, when I met my father-in-law, he's a cancer surgeon. And he has a really warped idea about how much I should earn per hour. And I'm taking Chinese history and philosophy, got hair down to here, riding a little Honda 125 motorcycle from Fort Collins down to Denver. You know, got a mainline and people are passing by me, you know. But everything was cool. I was just, had me a Pacer. Anybody ever? An AMC Pacer, just like Wayne's World, you know. That was a good car. I could sleep in the back of that car, lay down. It worked out great for me. I could carry my motorcycle on the bumper back in the back. Yeah, it was a deal. And that was a magical summer. The first summer, it was just one of those magical summers. A lot of things came together. I wasn't drinking heavily or anything. But my father-in-law asked me, he said, what are you going to do with that? You know? And I said, well, I've always considered myself a Renaissance man. He said, what the hell is that? And I said, well, you know, back in the Renaissance, you study ants for a couple of months or whatever, write a book on it, you're the world's expert on ants, and then study cannonballs flying or art or piano or something like that. And it turns out that's kind of what I've done in my life. I've become a specialized at being a generalist. There's a lot of people who are good specialists in any one area, but there's not a lot of people who can communicate between all those different places. And I just find everything fast. I just find things fascinating. Today, for me, one of the great things to remember, I don't want to spend my life in acceptance. Now, I'll tell you what, acceptance is a very good start if you're in pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. Great step up. How about terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair? Yeah, acceptance is a wonderful start. But I'll tell you what, I don't want to have to live there. Because then I've got negative opinions about all the stuff that I'm having to accept. So what I want to do is be in wonder and awe. If I'm in wonder and awe, I don't need acceptance. What I'm finding, whatever I had a negative opinion about before, I'm finding out I can really find out what's wonderful about that. The person I had a negative opinion about, the book tells me and the process tells me, find out what's wonderful about them. Look at what the fourth step is. What is it? Find out something. Change the story. I want to try and make this theme here tonight, and that is what somebody said down at the Rock. He said, if nothing changes, nothing changes. Nothing changes. So what this is about, it's about change. Fourth step's about change. Third step, change. Second, all of those steps are about change. And it's a change not because I changed wrong ways, but it's about changing towards quality. Changing towards universally accepted principles. Changing towards what my inner sense of guilt tells me I should be. See, one of the things I'm so grateful for today is my inner sense of guilt. It's my inner compass. I like this guy who came in and has told the sponsor, says, I feel so guilty. He said, well, hell, you are. You know? Guilty, you know? Guilty in a lot of different ways. But there is on TED.com, there's a very interesting piece about an MIT doctorate, and she does this study where she reads 1,000 different stories. And she comes up with a theme, and she came up with this theme that said the world is broken into two kinds of people. I like this one guy said, there's two types of people in the world. Those who break the world into two types of people and those who don't. I kind of think they like that one. But anyway, so she said what she found out was the two types of people were those who had a sense of well-being and those who wanted to have a sense of well-being. She said what's interesting about the people who have a sense of well-being is they're okay with being vulnerable. They're the ones to reach out first and to come, you know, to take the risk because they recognize it's not always going to work, but they're okay being vulnerable. They're okay with people not thinking well about them. They're okay with all of that. Then on the second group is the group, and they have shame. Now, shame is not guilt. Shame says that God made a mistake when he made me. He made a mistake. Guilt says I have done wrong things. You know. And there also, she said that there was a unique quality, a unique fear that each one had, and that was the fear of being found out for what they were shameful about. You know? And then all of a sudden she had to pause because she realized she's on the other half. So she got her a psychiatrist for psychiatrist, she said, because she needed one with a good bullshit meter, is what she said. And she goes in with a clipboard and she says, all right, here's the game plan. We're not going to talk about family stuff. And I need coping mechanisms. That's what I want, coping mechanisms. And the psychiatrist just nodded her head. And the researcher looked at her and says, it's bad, isn't it? No, it's not good or bad. You know, it's just something we have to work on. So we're not the only ones that have that. But I think a lot of what I see in this transformation is they're transforming shame into guilt. And then we're making the amends. And we're taking the corrective action. So that we can find out, the moral inventory says, let's look at that structure of your life that's good. Let's look at that stuff within you that's worth keeping. This is a moral inventory, not an immoral inventory. And they said to Meister Eckhart in the 1200s, he said that spiritual growth is largely a process of subtraction, not addition. But I've seen people come in to AA, guys I've tried to sponsor, and what they want to do is try and spray paint AA on the outside of their current design for living. You know? And they want to kind of look like they're doing, but inside they're not doing an internal structural change. You've got to rip out sometimes the drywall. You've got to go look at what the plumbing's happening. You've got to look into it and be willing to take a chance, rip it out. Maybe we're going to put it back in. Maybe that was actually, but be prepared to do that. We're talking about a complete psychic change. I don't think you get that on aisle 4 at Walgreens. You know? This is a step-by-step process. And I'll tell you, if you're new in the program, I've been and met a lot of different people. We mean you no harm. We mean you no harm. We're just trying to show you what we did and why it was worth the effort for doing it. So anyway, we get married. In fact, I broke off with my wife because she didn't want to go to China. I wanted to go to China and teach English, and she didn't want to go. And I decided that I went around Colorado with my parents for a couple of weeks and came back and hooked back up with my wife because of this. I wanted her to be the mother of my children. And that's been a very, very good suggestion. That has been a great decision. Well, she wanted to come back to Atlanta. By the way, in that time frame, I had kind of stopped school for a little bit. And I began working at a nursing home for about a year as an orderly. And I started seeing people looking back on 105 years of life, 75 years of marriage. It's still today a good, large component of my life. I love to be talking to people looking back on that much life. It tells me what's really important. Bill talks about insanity being a lack of proportion when he talks about Jim putting the whiskey in the milk. It is. It's a lack of proportion. I get a lot of proportion. I had a lot of proportion when I saw people looking back on what was important. It wasn't what they did. It wasn't what they did in their career or what they did. It's how they did what they did that was important to them. At the last time in their life, they go, how did I do my life? That was what was important. Again, how it works was important. Not why I did what I did. There's another of the TED.com I love. It's this EMT. And, you know, ambulance driver. And he would not tell people when they were going to die. You know, they would ask him, you know, if they were lucid enough. And he'd say, we're doing everything we can. Well, this one time on a motorcycle accident, he told the guy, he said, yeah, you're going to die. And he said, this peace came over the guy. And the next time he did, it was an old guy having a heart attack. And the guy says, am I going to die? And he said, well, yeah. And then the peace came over him again. And then the old man said, I should have spent more time with my kids and my grandkids. And then there was a lady T-boned in a car, and he's in the car with them, and they're trying to use the jaws of life to get the lady out, and it's going to take 45 minutes. And she asked the question, and he says, yes, you are. And the peace came over her again. And she said, I wish my life would have meant more. Then the EMT finds out this lady has adopted 3 kids, and they're all in medical school. He goes back and he talks about the motorcycle driver and the motorcycle driver asking this question, will you remember me? And you know, at that point in life, some peace came over them and there was those 3 questions. Will you remember me? Will you forgive me? Was it all worthwhile? Now, what I can answer those questions for me when I lay my head on the pillow at night, that's what this program gives me. I can answer those questions today based on how I treat you today. Because the way you can do that on a whole lifetime is to do it one day at a time. So we come back, and I wind up finishing up my undergraduate in history and finishing it at Georgia State. By the way, it's funny, they went to get me to graduate, and I'd had a couple of computer courses, and they found out they couldn't test me in Chinese, and they said, well, wait, you've had Fortran. I said, that's a computer language. He said, yeah, but it's spoken all over the world. So my undergraduate degree is in history, especially in India and China. My foreign language is Fortran, which is computer language. But I wound up getting into computers, and it was a natural thing for me. I think what it is in some ways is that a computer programming is the history of data moving through a system. And there's concepts and interrelated, and it works out pretty well. And so I wound up doing all this stuff and getting into all these different things and exploring. You know, I'm that explorer. I'm not, you know, the Renaissance guy, and I'm into this and a little bit of that. And I wound up getting an offer from Equifax to work in their marketing research division. And then they sent me to school after a gap, and I finished up my master's degree. And all along this time, you know, my son is born in 1984. My wife's gotten a job as an occupational therapist. She's working down in Georgia Tech. She's been there now over 35 years. She's working with people with disabilities, taking technology and using that to help people. And then my son's born, my daughter's born in 1989. And let me tell you, though, something started happening. William James, in the book Varieties of Religious Experience, is the book that Bill Wilson was given right after he had his hot flash, as he called it, in around December 12th of 1934. And this book is written by the father of American psychology, William James. And in it, he wants to talk about the nature of a spiritual experience, but he wants to not talk about religion. In fact, the book is a real slow start because he's all going to talk about what he's not talking about. But then when he gets into it, he starts talking about what's common about people who have a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience. And two things that struck me that I remember from it. One is we don't find God on the mountaintops. We find God in the valleys. Anybody in here find God in the valleys? The other thing is there's a shift from pessimism to optimism. Now, what happened in the end of the 80s, I did not drink alcoholically. I'd watch my wife on New Year's Eve, and my neighbor and I would watch them get drunk. But I started thinking about what was wrong with my life, what was wrong with my wife. She is not the kind of woman who would be a corporate executive's wife, and I'm going up the corporate ladder, and she's not going to do. She's just not going to do for that. She likes to collect species. I was the first one she collected. We've had goats. We had to bury an alpaca. By the way, try and bury an alpaca sometime. It's really 150 pounds. We've had ducks and geese and turkeys. She's actually got an aquarium over the sink, and it's got scum and stuff growing in it. But she's doing it, she's raising snails. Now, it used to be a real live aquarium, but it got taken over by the snails, and she just likes the snails. I go, okay, fine, you know, I'm okay with that today. That kind of stuff, but also she had a lot of clutter, actually. It was clutter back then. And she was clutter all over the, and I didn't have hallways, I had little aisleways where the boxes were sitting in the hallways. And so I don't want to come home to all of that. And so I'm going from optimism to pessimism. And I'm my negative opinions. Let me tell you what I love the 10th tradition. The fewer opinions I have on outside issues, the less I get drawn into controversy. When I start practicing the traditions in my life, it's amazing. That's one of the changes. You know, today I've got one negative opinion, and that's about negative opinions. You know, I haven't found where a negative opinion actually protected me. I thought they were protecting me. Like, the shields are up, Scotty. You know? What are we trying to do? Resentment's the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. What does it start with? How can you have a resentment without starting with a negative opinion? How can you get rid of a resentment without changing that opinion? I don't know if it's possible. So, I've got a guy working for me. He goes to a bachelor. It's a bachelor party. We wind up going to a strip joint. I'm going to be along with the guys. They have a pull your pants down club there that's a lot better than the one I had at 6 years old. And then about a couple of weeks later or so, I decide to go get a massage, and this lady offers the full treatment, and I accept it. I'm not getting this at home. But then I said, you know, in China and Japan, they have concubines. You know, this is a woman on the side. The wife knows, oh, I'm not going to tell my wife about this. You know, I'm not in China or Japan. My wife's not China. This is called delusion. This is also rationalization and justification. Anybody else practice rationalization and justification? You know? The mind, when faced with sufficient conflict, will alter its view of reality in order to resolve the conflict. Clancy. I heard that from Clancy. I love it. The mind, when faced with sufficient conflict, will alter its view of reality in order to resolve the conflict. And the conflict with me was back in that inner sense of guilt. See, Mama raised me better than that. Well, anyway, I start drinking more, start going to the strip joints, doing all of this. I'm working now for Hewlett-Packard, a big job with their outsourcing division. It's 24/7, so nobody really knows when I'm supposed to be where I'm supposed to be, because I'm also the silo guy. Remember the silo guy? So I could be here, I could be there, you know. And I'm like a chameleon. I'm shifting around. But I'm going out. My way of drinking, you'd love drink with me, go out to a little tennis court and hide back in there and listen to Neil Bortz and G. Gordon Liddy while I drank vodka and then go back to work. You know, that was me. That was my style of drinking. Okay, that's alcoholic drinking. There's nothing social about that. Well, anyway, somebody smelled that on my breath one time around these millions of dollars of equipment, and I got put on probation. And that was in April of 2001, and I quit. And then I turned on the afterburners. Anybody else do that? You know, dazzle them. Let's dazzle them. You know, can't baffle them. Let's dazzle them. You know, I was trying to hide and get away. Can't do that. Okay, let's dazzle them. Let's turn it on. Okay. And I was getting accolades and all this. And then a presidential candidate fired everybody who was on probation. Carly, you know, the gal who was running. So I got fired by a presidential candidate. I feel unique, what can I say? But I told them, you know, and it really surprised a lot of people because I was sneaking around, you know, and they didn't know about that. And I said, I'm going to come back here next year a millionaire. Today I am a millionaire many times over in an entirely different currency. You see, I didn't want the car. I wanted the way I thought it would feel when I got the car. I didn't want the stuff. I wanted the way I thought it would feel when I got the stuff. Did you ever have enough stuff? Isn't this the disease of not enough? What I need to do is turn my sobriety into abundance. We're swimming in abundance. We're an amazing planet in an amazing place that's got everything we need. There's an old Chinese text that says, the universe is benevolent and giving, perfect in its design. I have all that I require. And I'm going to tell you about that perfect. This is another change. And that is my definition of perfection. We rate very highly on a perfectionist scale. And, you know, it's this idea, if I can't do it perfect, don't even try and do it. If you can't do it perfect, you know. Now, what I needed is I needed a perfect definition of perfection, and this is the one I used. You are perfectly you at this moment. There's nobody more perfectly you at this moment than you are at this moment. This moment is perfectly this moment. There's never been a moment more perfectly this moment than this moment is. What I used to think perfection was this moment had to be what I thought this moment should be. You see, my expectations. What it turns out is I had a broken expector. I thought the universe had it wrong because it wasn't the way I expected it. What do we say? We had to quit playing God? I mean, what kind of an ego does it take to say the universe has got it wrong because it's not the way I expected? I have to change my definition of perfection. And then I can cut other people around me some slack. What is the resentment? But I'm not cutting them some slack. You know? So I wind up not drinking until 9/11 hits. I'm over in Birmingham working on building a program, doing this whole business thing I'm going to do. I'm over at my sister's house. I watch the planes go into the towers, and I know my industry's changed. I was right about that, by the way. And I held out for 3 more days. They went to a German club, and they went, and I said, no, I'm not going to get around the alcohol. But I knew where the blackjack was. You know where it's at, no one? We get into the place, we know where the stuff, the solution is, because that's my solution. And so I thought I'd have one. I wound up having 3. Because now I like pleasure by sneaking around. I don't drink the whole bottle. I'm not a drink the whole bottle and guy and get caught. I'm just not, it's not my MO. You know where I was the next morning at 9 o'clock? Come on, you guys know. I'm waiting at the liquor store. Guess what? It doesn't open until 9:30. You know what I do? I don't go back and say, no, I'm going to not drink. Thank God you're doing something for me. No, I said, I waited. I'll tell you what, if I continue to do these things, continue to go to places where I'm asked to go, continue to step up and get into service, continue to do all the things that are suggested to me, I will never, ever have to be the guy sitting in the parking lot waiting for the liquor store to open. Who is the boss then? Alcohol became our master. King Alcohol, shivering denizens of his mad realm. Anyway, there was a Marcel Marceau is a pantomimist, and he did a, I saw him live in Atlanta way back in the 60s or sometime. And he, you know, he's the white face guy, and he does this thing where he's walking along, and he's just tuddling around, and all of a sudden he hits something. And then he dances around and he finds out that it's a box and it's getting smaller and smaller and smaller and smaller and gets down on the ground and he reaches and he pulls the box over his head and he brushes himself off and he starts walking along again and hits another box. And that was the next 2 years, 3 years of my life. I would quit drinking for a while and then the pressure would build up. I'd run into the box again. I was a fifth of vodka a day guy. All this time, I'm still getting pleasure by sneaking around, doing all. Well, anyway, in 2003, I've quit drinking for 3 months from September, and it comes up on Thanksgiving. I'm over in Birmingham again with this family. I don't have any problem, and there's no tensions, and there's no arguments building, and nothing to get. But I go to an ATM, I get $300 out that I don't even have really, you know, because I'm not really bringing any money. It's my wife's money. Because she's the one still working there. And I drive all the way, make an excuse, I got a client in Atlanta. I don't got a client in Atlanta. And I drive all the way from Birmingham to Atlanta going, don't think about what you're doing, don't think, la, 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 la. I go to the Mardi Gras. I go to a Cheshire Bridge Road. 3 days later, I've got 105 degree temperature. I'm in real bad shape. I'm sure I've got some sort of sexually transmitted disease. Fever breaks, all of a sudden, something happens, but I am now passing gas and debris when I go to the bathroom and I pee. This is in December, 03. In February, I go to the doctor. Anybody else do wishful thinking? Now, I go and I pee into a cup. Yeah, I'm not going to pee into a cup. I let him do this little swab test, but because I don't want him to take away my solution. I don't want him to find out that I had to drink alcohol just to get to the doctor's office. Now I'm not having the ups and downs of boxing. I'm drinking all the time. And they don't find anything. My wife finally again makes me go in May because she knows something wrong. She just doesn't know what it is. And I finally tell the doctor what's going on. And I like this guy said we should go to veterinarians because they're used to treating patients who won't tell them what's going on. And I like that, you know. But finally I told the guy what was going on and this was great. There's so many kind souls in the medical field that have helped. I love it when the nurses come into the meetings and I can sit and talk with them and say, you know, help out. We need to educate them as much as we can. They're the first line of defense for us. They need to understand what they can do and what they can't do. And he said, oh, you're self-medicating. Well, that took a long time to figure out. Yeah, I feel this way. I'm going to write the prescription. I'm going to go get it. I'm going to administer it. You know, I feel this way. Let me tell you, Ann Smith, Dr. Bob's wife, she kept a journal from 1933 to 1939. Very interesting. We don't actually have the journal. That's in the archives, but a guy wrote a book about it. And in there, she said something very amazing. She said, feelings are the fruit, not the root of my faith. So the idea is this. Feelings are the physiological reaction of the body to a thought. We have a machine that measures, it's called a lie detector. Right? They hook you up the lie detector, ask you questions, you know, and my mind senses my body feeling something, my body senses, you know, feels, you know, and it's this feedback loop, like taking this microphone, putting it up to the speaker, you know, don't worry, I'm not going to do it. Okay. But anyway, so the idea that she's saying is I shouldn't act on my feelings. When I heard an old timer say, I don't give a damn how you feel, I thought it was the cruelest thing you could say, and I find out it's one of the kindest. I should not really care how it, when I act on how I feel, I am rolling the dice, because I don't know what kind of thought that came from. My feelings are very, very unimportant today in that sense. But what she's saying, feelings are the fruit, not the root. What I do today is when I do these things, when I practice these principles in all my affairs, at the end of the day, I reach up and I pluck the succulent fruit of a day well spent. I harvest my feelings. I don't act on them. I should be acting on principles and harvesting feelings. I was acting on feelings and harvesting crap. On occasions, actually, though, it'd be good. See, that's the crazy thing about acting on my feelings. And that's what will throw you off. That's the baffling part about it. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. The principles are very reliable. And these are two for me that I've kind of get down and I kind of really use these two. They help me. And that's kindness and integrity. I can't rob a bank with kindness and integrity. I can't gossip about you behind your back with kindness. I can tell people your good qualities behind your back. I can do all these other things. But those two, if I just kind of focus on those, they kind of interconnect with everything else. They're kind of complicated concepts, actually. But when I learn more and more what they really mean, then the results are always favorable. I have not had a non-favorable result. Now, sometimes it looks unfavorable, and I just wait, and I go, oh, now I see the rest of the story. So finally, in July, my wife gives me an ultimatum letter, and basically, you know, we may lose the house, and you may not be invited. We're living in the same house, but I get a letter. And on August the 9th of 2004, I decided to quit drinking again on the old plan, the Damon Stops Himself plan. And I told her I'd made an appointment with Kaiser to go to their behavioral services, and I hadn't made the appointment. But I'm kicking on my own for 2 days. I'm over in the park listening to G. Gordon Liddy and Neil Borton, but I'm not drinking. And the pressure's building up. Finally, Thursday morning at 3 o'clock in the morning. I've had my 1 hour of sleep. Anybody else battle the ghosts on the ceilings? And, you know, that white ceiling out there. On my 1 hour of sleep, and I said the three-word prayer of an atheist, because, you see, I had decided there was no God because I could not find God in my understanding. I could not find a logical explanation for God that worked. So there obviously wasn't any God if I couldn't understand God. Wow, that's an ego. So I said the three-word prayer, and I said it down deep inside. I fully admitted to my innermost self, and I said, I need help. And I said it with depth, and I said it with meaning, and I have not had the desire to drink since that point. I knew nothing about AA except it had God in it. Next morning I called, and I was tired. I'll tell you what, I made a decision to stop lying. I had so many plates spinning all the time. I was tired of keeping the plates spinning. Anybody else get tired of keeping the plate spinning? Who you told what to the? And I went and I woke my wife up after I got my daughter off to school, and I said, I've been a son of a bitch. That's the words I used. And I basically outlined everything I'm doing. I've been smoking cigarettes for 8 to 10 years out the bathroom window. I didn't tell her about that till the next Tuesday, but I quit smoking that day. I quit smoking like 3 days after I quit drinking, because it was the same thing. It was all a lie. And when I got tired of lying, something happened. And suddenly that inner sense of guilt won out, and I'm going to let it direct me rather than I call the ego. The ego gets a bad rap sometimes. I think it's the life support system for this thing I'm running around in, you know? And there's some amazing things that the ego can do. Bill even talks about it on 85. It's the proper use of the will. And he used his willpower to build this organization in a way that's beautiful. The ego in and of itself, it's just a tool. It's not like a bad hammer, bad screwdriver, good hammer, good screwdriver. It's just a tool. When it's running the show, though, I've got a problem. I need that innermost self. God, you know, Bill says we find God in the last place. You know, deep down inside every man, woman, and child is a fundamental idea of God. It is there to which he should be found. That's where I needed to look. That's what I think awakened. So I called up Kaiser, and they said, well, we can get you in on August 31st. And I said, I don't think you understand. I've been drinking a fifth of vodka a day. I'm ready. And they said, okay. And I made the physical appointment for the what somebody called the tuba thing that was still going on. And they called me back, and I went that next week and entered into the treatment, went over to 8111. When I came into 8111, because, you know, I was not going to go to AA, but then it was on the syllabus. You know, and I was an old college guy, 200 hours. Okay, go to AA. Okay, fine. I got to do it. When I walked into 8111, you know what I saw? I saw these, the 12 traditions. You see, I'm a contracts guy. Remember all the big contracts? I looked at those and I said, these son of a guns have taken away every possible excuse I could have for not being a member. And the other thing I said, those could work. I studied a lot of different business. I was doing marketing. We were doing 20. I had lots of different companies and organizations. I went, first of all, I recognized how unique that was. I'd never seen anything like that in any of the businesses I'd studied. And I saw that it also had just done exactly what it needed to do, was take away every excuse I had for not becoming a member. And today I live by those in my marriage, and my wife doesn't need to know anything about them. I've heard that Wesley Parrish, if you ever get a chance to listen to him, a guy from the 70s, an old-timer, talking about taking and incorporating the traditions in our lives. It may be, in some ways, I think it's in some ways it'd be a good idea to make it the first thing we study. Because then we can start getting along with people, and we can finally let go of the resentments. But that's a great tool. So during this time, I know I'm coming up on the hour, right? So we're coming up on that time. Many, many things have happened. My mom died of cancer. I was able to be there for her. I was able to not plan my grief so that I wasn't part of her problem. And I had some amazing experiences there. And I didn't have a grieving period really for her. What I had was gratitude for having her. Her natural state of being was being of service. And I got to be there for her in the end and be there on a regular basis to come be there with her. My dad died in 2012. I'd gone down. He just had a little spell and he was in the hospital. I got to be there for him for 72 hours. And I asked him on the Friday before, because after my mom died, his energy for life had just gone out. You know? And I just looked at him. I said, Dad, do you want to live or do you want to die? I said, it's okay. I mean, I think a man's got a right to make that decision. And he said, I want to live. I said, well, then you probably need to act like it. You know? But I'd made my amends. I'd been there for my dad. I'd tried to be the son I wasn't. You see, there's two kinds of real sins. You know, the character defects and shortcomings in some ways can be looked at sins of omission and sins of commission. Things I committed and things I failed to do. And I got a chance to make, and when I turned around at 3:45 in the morning, I heard the nurse come in. I looked over and I knew he was dead before she did. I'd been in the nursing care area. And I actually wound up comforting the nurses. Let me tell you something really quick here. That Friday, I went downstairs into the parking deck to get a change of shirt, and there was a change of watch happening, so the people were coming in to, you know, for the hospital. And this guy comes walking to me in scrubs, and nobody else did I think this. I said, I wonder how he's going to play in all of this. And it turns out he was the lead team on the resuscitation team that came up there, and he's the man who told me my father had passed. He was the official person down in front of me. You see, I retired as an atheist because these things are happening to me all the time. And I found out today that my faith is much larger than my belief, and I hope my belief gets smaller and smaller and smaller as I get older. See, because what I believe is actually going on can't be what's going on. I'd have to be able to understand the mind of God and the whole way the universe is put together. It's okay that I don't need to have a story talking about why these things work the way they work. What I get to do is I get to rely on the power behind the principles and just trust and rely on the principles and not try and figure them out. And as a result, those are some of the key changes that I've had. And the biggest change is, today on a daily basis, I do this. I change the story I'm telling myself about what I think is going on, such that it adds to the quality of the lives of the people around me, not me. I do not need to add to the quality of my life. I spent way too much time doing that. I need to focus on what I can do to add to the quality of your life. And then I get quality by reflection. And it's a much higher quality by reflection than anything I could have manufactured by accumulating all the stuff that I had. The second thing I do really is to change that definition of perfection. And the main thing for me is to realize that it's not that the glass is half full or the glass is half empty. It's that there's such a thing as glass and such a thing as water. A star had to explode for us to get glass, because the first stars were nothing but hydrogen, and then it had to coalesce into another solar system. Two big, large planetoids had to collide together to create this Earth-Moon system that stirred up all the weather and stirred up all the oceans until it ground down all the rocks into sand, and somehow life formed, got up there, learned how to deal with fire, looked down in the fire, and saw glass. I tell you what, I like these guys. They took the glass beads and gave them to the women. I can identify with that. But then they later on figured out what you could do with it. We've got glass. It's thousands and thousands. Billions of years have gone by in order to make glass. And water? We're sitting on a planet that is in a perfect place where three forms of water, ice, vapor, and water, can occur. That's astonishing. I like this little Indian yogi. He said, to know reality, you must be astonished. And you know what for the alcoholic? It wasn't enough. To be in one of the most amazing places in the whole universe, we're sending out probes trying to find people like you. We can't find anything even close to who we are. And it wasn't enough. Wonder and awe. May each and every one of you just find a little bit of wonder and awe in the world around you and in the people around you today. Thank you for letting me share.